He's trying to introduce me.
I know.
Hecklers.
But she's a dear friend of ours, and so great that she gives us a little time to be with us, to share with us some of her work. And this group, as you know, we have been working for, just been coming to a finishing a year of training.
Yeah.
And being with people in hospital and hospices. And today we've just been talking about grief and loss.
Yeah. I'm so moved by you. I mean, I really do feel very humbled in your presence. A lot of my friends have died, and my brother and my parents, and a good friend has recently died. And I was spending, time with her, quite a bit of time with her in the last month, and I thought of you guys a lot, actually. She really wasn't dying until maybe the last 2 days, and I didn't see her then. She was a very long-term survivor of fourth stage cancer. She was supposed to die 20 years ago. Yeah, amazing woman. Her name was Kathy Rich. Extraordinary person. She kept saying, no, it's just genetic. But she really, she went, here's what I loved about Kathy. Well, some bazillion things, but I loved about the way Kathy was when she was dying, when she was living, until she died, was that she, about 2 weeks before she died, she wheeled down to Eileen Fisher and got herself new clothes. And then I came over about a week before she died, and she had a whole new chair from ABC Carpet and Home. I was like, my brain went, how can you buy a new chair? And I thought, yay, she bought a new chair. It was just so great. It was such a teaching, really, for me, Pardon me?
Home credit, I hope.
What?
I said home credit.
Well, one of her friends will get that chair, I'm sure. But the thing is, it was just living, And she just lived and lived and lived and lived. And one of the very last days I saw her, she was lying in bed. Usually she was up when I came over. She was bald and she couldn't walk and she was 80 pounds, but she was radiant and funny and awake. And but this day she really couldn't get out of bed for a while, so I went in and I sort of was like, oh, she's really, this is getting serious. And I said, we were both in 12-step programs, so we would read from the book and talk to each other. So we did that, and I said, so do you want me to, maybe you need to sleep some more, or do you think I should, do you want me to sit here? She said, no, I'm going to get up and go outside. I'm like, excuse me? I said, just excuse me a minute. I went to the kitchen to where her health aide was, and I said, she says she's going to get up and go outside. She says, oh, yeah, we'll be out for hours. In fact, I think I'll go get her now. And she, put her in this wheelchair, put her wig on, put the clothes on, and they were down across 14th Street, into the pharmacy, doing their errands. I couldn't even keep up with them. And I was, again, wait a minute, you're supposed to be dying. I was thinking, I was so flummoxed by her refusal to act like a dying person. So, I wanted to read you a poem I pulled up on the iPhone. Maybe some of you know it. Well, first, you guys like poetry. Do you read it?
Yeah.
Who do you read?
Marie
Howe. Oh. No, who else?
Mary Oliver.
Sure. David White, who?
Rilke,
yeah. Jack Gilbert.
Who?
D.H. Lawrence.
Sharon.
Phil.
Billy.
The life givers. You're reading all the beautiful life givers. I read all these people too. These are my favorites too.
Denise.
Hold on, I'm sorry. Do you know Merwin? W.S. Merwin?
Yeah.
He lives in Hawaii now. He's, he takes care of a forest, apparently. Has anyone ever been, anyone ever heard him read or speak? He's not in New York much anymore. But this is a poem I was thinking about earlier this morning when I was thinking about you all and thinking about how, you know, Zen, of course, is a great religion, that religion, whatever it is. Zen is the whatever it is that reminds us, you know, that we are going to, each of us, of course, is living and dying at the same time. And this poem holds that knowledge too with such kind of joy. It's called "For the Anniversary of My Death." You know it. Every year, without knowing it, I have passed the day when the last fires will wave to me and the silence will set out, tireless traveler, like the beam of a lightless star. Then I will no longer find myself in life as in a strange garment, surprised at the earth and the love of one woman and the shamelessness of men. As today, writing after 3 days of rain, hearing the wren sing and the falling cease and bowing, not knowing to what. Isn't that beautiful? Want to hear it again?
Yep.
For the anniversary of my death. I was thinking, I mean, actually, there will be a day that is associated with us, by our loved ones, right? My mother died. I keep forgetting what day she died for some reason. And we had all these emails among my many siblings. It was this, and it was that, it was this, no, it was that. And I thought, why do we forget? Well, that's a whole other story. Why can't we remember the date? But other dates are indelible to me, as I'm sure they are to you. For the anniversary of my death, every year without knowing it, I have passed the day when the last fires will wave to me and the silence will set out, tireless traveler, like the beam of a lightless star. Then I will no longer find myself in life as in a strange garment, surprised at the earth and the love of one woman and the shamelessness of men. As today, writing, after 3 days of rain, hearing the wren sing and the falling cease, and bowing, not knowing to what. When I was with Kathy was such a survivor, you know, often she would say, it's going to be okay, I think it's going to be okay, I think it's going to be okay, I think it's going to be okay. And here's where you guys helped me. You really did. I was really aware of you two with me, in particular, too. One day, and I went over there, and she said, you know, she goes, maybe it's not going to be okay. And I haven't been in this whole year-long course of thought and action that you have been in. But I've hung around a little bit with these two guys, and because you were with me, I knew just to say, what does that mean, that it's not going to be okay? You know? And she said, well, I might die. And I said, well, is that not okay? Like, what do we know about that? And just I just could ask some questions, and I'm really grateful to you for that. that we think the end of what we know is not okay. I want to read you a kind of wicked poem. It's by Tony Hoagland. Anybody here know Tony Hoagland's work? Tony was chronically ill for a long time. He's okay now, but he went through a long, long period where daily life was very difficult for him. And his mother had died of cancer. So here's a poem called Medicine. The black hair of my Chinese doctor gleams like combed ink, and he leans over his desk with quick pen strokes, writing my prescription in the lingo of the I Ching. Characters so intricate and strange, the page looks like a street, lined with sampans and pagodas, rickshaws gliding through the palace gates, bringing Sichuan takeout to the king. Daydreaming comes easy to the ill. Slow down to the speed of waiting rooms. You learn to hang suspended in the wallpaper, to drift among the magazines and plants, feeling a strange love for the time that might be killing you. 2 years ago, I was so infatuated with my lady doctor, Linda. I wanted to get better just to please her. And yet, to go on getting worse, to keep her leaning toward me with her sea-green eyes and stethoscope, asking, "Does that hurt? Does it hurt?" Yes, it hurts so sweet. It hurts exquisitely. It hurts real good. I feel as if I read it in some Bible for the ill, that suffering itself is medicine, and to endure enough will cure you of everything. So I want more injury and repair, an ulcer and a migraine, please. I want to suffer like my mother, who said once, following a shot, her face joyful as the needle entered, that she felt a train had been injected straight into her vein. Day after day, to see her sinking through the layers of our care was to learn something delicious about weakness, as if she had discovered the train was bound somewhere, as if the conductor had told everyone on board they never had to bear the weight of being strong again. Isn't that great? Complicated. And what's so cool about it, of course, and my friend Jason writes about this, a lot of people I've known who have been terminally ill, I guess we'll call it, for lack of a better word, there's a certain sweetness to it because everyone's paying attention to you. Or more people than usual. You know, people say, "How does this feel? Does it hurt? How do you feel? Da da da." And we don't do that enough to each other just every day, you know? So there's this sense of tender attention that is actually kind of pleasant. That I think that we forget that we can bring that to people. Here's a really wicked one by Tony. Want to hear it? It's called Lucky. He had a very ambivalent relationship with his mother. Maybe some of us know what that's like. Lucky. If you are lucky in this life, you will get to help your enemy. The way I got to help my mother when she was weakened past the point of saying no. Into the big enamel tub, half filled with water, which I had made just right, I lowered the childish skeleton she had become. Her eyelids fluttered as I soaped and rinsed her belly and her chest, the sorry ruin of her flanks, and the frayed gray cloud between her legs. Some nights, sitting by her bed, book open in my lap, while I listened to the air move thickly in and out of her dark lungs, my mind filled up with praise as lush as music, amazed at the symmetry and luck that would offer me the chance to pay my heavy debt of punishment and love with love and punishment. And once I held her dripping wet in the uncomfortable air between the wheelchair and the tub until she begged me like a child to stop. An act of cruelty we both understood was the ancient, irresistible rejoicing of power over weakness. If you are lucky in this life, you will get to raise the spoon of pristine, frosty ice cream to the trusting creature mouth of your old enemy, because the taste buds at least are not broken, because there is a bond between you, and sweet is sweet in any language. It's called Donkey Gospel. And it came out from Gray Wolf Press, Donkey Gospel. That poem's called Lucky. Tony's great about, he is brave and funny, and he's a master of the simile and metaphor. And he is able to write about the shadow, you know, which is difficult You know, what do you do when you're taking care of someone and who you love, 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 you would die for, but you really wish they would either get better or die? You know, what do you do when you're with someone you would do anything for, but you really have to pee and they don't want you to leave the room? Whatever, you know? So his poems are great in that way. Some people find them very unnerving. He can get even more unnerving. But I love that. I love that he does that, especially about this subject, which is such a sort of sacred subject. Very few people will allow the shadow in. My brother died of AIDS, John. And when it became clear that he was going to decline, because it was the 80s and people died then, as you know. When it became clear that he was going to go home and it was going to be, you know, a few months maybe at the most, although it wasn't a few months, just maybe a month, I said, well, I'll come home and take care of you. He goes, no way, you are not going to give me a shower, you know. No, you know. And he was very, very insistent on that. The being, you know, maintaining the same relationship we'd had. I'll read you a little poem about John. He's Joe didn't. Joe's whole thing was very interesting. It's an incredible story. I've tried to write this story many times, and I have not been able to do it. But when we were children, I mean, our family was a very large family. There were 9 children in my family. I was the oldest girl, second oldest person. This is back in the 50s, you know. And we had a maid. A woman who was our babysitter and maid, who was an African-American woman, Dorothy Allen. She lived with us for a few years, and then she had kids of her own, and she would come every day, you know, in her white uniform and live with, you know, hang out all day with us and often babysat for us when our parents went away, and we were really close to her. And when we got older, you know, she stopped coming every day, and she would come to clean maybe, or she would come just different reasons. We were having a big party or something. So we were in touch with her though. Anyway, when Johnny realized he was really, you know, gonna die, we were sitting around his hospital room, him and I, it's like, well, he said, I want Dorothy Allen. I said, well, Dorothy Allen's in her 60s. I mean, she may not want to. I mean, really? And he said, yeah. She diapered me when I was a baby. She can diaper me when I'm a man. I need a Dorothy Allen. He goes, Marie, if you made a sandwich and you brought it to me, it would not be right. John was fastidious. But Dorothy Allen, she makes you a sandwich, she puts it down, that's the way it is, you know? I mean, she was a relief that way. She was just, you know? She had confidence, you know? So I went back. My mother was recovering from a heart attack. She was in another hospital. That's a whole other thing. But I said, John was Dorothy Allen. And also his having AIDS was a secret. This was, you know, again in the 80s. Well, we called her. I remember sitting next to mom saying, tell her. He's got AIDS. He's got to know to make a real decision, you know? And she came. She said, yeah. She was there the next day. John and Dorothy spent the whole first morning together lying on the bed. They're both of them on his bed talking about old times. And then he heard her in the kitchen calling the phone company, you know, saying she could pay the bill. I mean, it was, well, the whole long history of people hiring people and no Social Security, you know, doesn't work. But anyway, she was there, and she gave him showers and baths, and she did everything. And she was there half a day for the rest of John's life. And as it turned out, the day after John died, her brother died of AIDS in Florida. And her girl, she has a family. One of her grown daughters is HIV, but she's still alive. Our families were very similar in many ways. We just, one lived in the ghetto and one lived in the suburbs, but we were very similar. Lots of addiction, but we were very similar. So that's a whole other story. Dorothy Allen's dead now. Magnificent person. Well, I think she is. Nine of us have different feelings about Dorothy. Some of the younger kids were like, I have a sister named Dorothy, and she said, I didn't like Dorothy Allen at all. She was so mean. I said, she wasn't mean. She said, she was. Once John and I were playing out in the front yard, and somehow John pushed me, and I fell off of this and onto the this and then onto the that, and she got the breath knocked out of her. You know, have you ever had that happen to you? We were like, she ran in to Dorothy Allen, who was watching soap operas, you know, and drinking Coca-Cola, and she's like, I can't breathe. And according to my sister, Dorothy Allen said, shut up, girl, you can breathe. I love that. Like you did. Like, who could not resist a woman who could say such a thing? Shut up, girl, you can breathe. She's great. Well, here is a poem about the thing you're most afraid of happening. You know, I probably, if someone had said to me, what's the worst thing that could happen, I would say that John would die. It was way before John got sick. We were just best friends. How some of it happened. My brother was afraid, even as a boy, of going blind. So deeply that he would turn the dinner knives away from looking at him, he said, as they lay on the kitchen table. He would throw a sweatshirt over those knobs that locked the car door from the inside. And once he dismantled a chandelier in the middle of the night when everyone was sleeping. We found the pile of sharp and shining crystals in the upstairs hall. So you understand, it was terrible. When they clamped his one eye open and put the needle in through his cheek and into his eye from underneath and left it there for a full minute before they drew it slowly out once a week for many weeks. He learned to lean into it, to settle down, he said, and still the eye went dead, ulcerated, breaking up green in his head as the other eye, still blue, and wide open, looked and looked at the clock. My brother promised me he wouldn't die after our father died. He shook my hand on a train going home one Christmas and gave me 5 years as clearly as he promised he'd be home for breakfast when I watched him walk into that New York City autumn night. By 9, I promise. And he did come back. And 5 years later, he promised 5 years more. So much for the brave pride of premonition, the worry that won't let it happen. You know, he said, I always knew I would die young. And then I got sober, and I thought, okay, I'm not. I'm going to see 30 and live to be an old man. And now it turns out that I am going to die. Isn't that funny? One day it happens. What you have feared all your life, the unendurably specific, the exact thing, no matter what you say or do. This is what my brother said. Here, sit closer to the bed so I can see you. You guys must see a lot of pain, you know, and that whole thing about pain is how it's indescribable and what kind of pain is it, you know. There's this thing about saving it, this fear that, you know, people say that people aren't afraid of dying, they're afraid of the pain of dying, right? You probably know more about this than I do. Or being alone. hardly ever read this poem, but I'll just read this poem. It's called Pain. He rose on the surface of it like a layer of water on the top of a wave that won't break. You've seen those swells, cold and moving like something breathing you can't see, collecting and collecting until it seemed uncontainable, heaving on and on, rising and rising and growing bigger. When it got very bad, he'd say, "Tell me a story." And after an hour or so, he'd say, "We got through that one, didn't we?" Until a day came when he said, "Marie, you know how we've been waiting for the big pain to come? I think it's here. I think this is it. I think it's been here all along." And he did take the morphine, and he died the next week. I'll tell you a funny story. Well, God, I mean, I really didn't want him to be in pain, you know, ever. And he took a lot of drugs. I mean, everybody who had AIDS, you know, 30,000 pills next to him. But he took a lot of medicine. Nobody wanted him to be in pain at all. But I'm stirred by the idea of saving something, you know. And then finding out that the thing you were saving it for, you've actually been living through. And that this is it. You know, this has been it all along. I mean, in many ways, the poem should just end there. Because that's what he found out, you know. But there's a really funny story about when he was taking the morphine morning, noon, and night. He would sleep, of course. And then he would wake up and be in pain, and then we would give him more morphine. And after about 2 days, we were very close to when he died, Joe and I, his lover, his beloved, his partner, and I would, I sat down next to John and said, "Johnny, you know," he woke up like, and it was time to give him the morphine. I said, "You know, when you take the morphine, you just sleep and sleep and sleep, and we don't get a chance to talk to you, and, you know, you're just not there." And he's like, "Uh-huh." "Where's the morphine?" Like, you know, like, "Uh-huh." And I was like, "Oh, sorry, sorry, sorry. You know, here's the morphine." It was like, oh, my God. That was so much of my life. I was like, well, what about my needs? I mean, it was like, you know, but you see, when you really are just really asleep. And he's like, "Mm-hmm, mm-hmm." He looks at me like, "And?" You know, it was so funny. Oh, just so funny. Just was laughed, just laughed and laughed. You know, really, you know, he had, I mean, he was dying of AIDS, you know, nothing worked in his body. It's like, he was blind, he was like, it's like, okay, here's the morphine, bye-bye, baby, you know. I mean, of course, he would surface, you know, for a few minutes here and there, but, you know, the last couple of days was, you know. So that's how I felt about it. But, you know, what I learned, you guys know this already, you've been practicing this all year, but what I didn't know how to do yet, you know, was to be company for someone who's in pain without inflicting my discomfort on them. And the greatest thing I learned from John was I practiced doing that, because I realized watching him yell, I mean, really be in terrible pain, and not going, "This is so hard," you know, I just to not add my pain to his pain was, of course, as a mother, anybody here is a parent, you know that too. I didn't know that either until a parent, because it's like you don't add your stuff to their stuff. You just let their stuff happen. And you use your love for them to let their stuff happen. But I didn't know that. I didn't know how to do that. And until I realized that John didn't want to carry any of my discomfort, you know, he couldn't carry that too. So that was a great thing to learn, you know, to begin to practice. I'm not saying I can do it, of course, but all the time. But you must deal with that, right?
To begin to.
Yeah, but you must deal with that. You know, when you're with company, and you're in company with someone, How do you not, this is so hard, you know? What do you do? You know, not to be false, you know? False. Like, my mother, forgive me, Mom, but I'm going to tell this story. Like, my mother would sit next to John and pray in a kind of drone that I found very upsetting because it didn't seem like she was really there. She wasn't inflicting her suffering on him, but she also didn't seem to be there, you know? So it was like, no, not like that. Like, it was hard. It's hard to find the place, you know? Without getting all, like, spiritual, like, to be real and still be there. Yeah. You must negotiate that all the time. Yeah. Minute to minute. Yeah. I want to read you a poem by my friend Jason, who died a few years ago and wrote amazing poems as he was walking toward that gate. Are we doing okay with time? I don't want to exhaust these good folks. Oh dear. Let me actually finish with this.
What's his last name?
Schindler. Jason Schindler. Okay. This is a poem called Appointment. Jason was in denial, we thought, the entire time he was ill. He died literally leaving the house standing up. He finally just fell down. He wouldn't ever get into bed. It drove us crazy as his close friends and caretakers. I'd meet him for coffee. He could hardly walk. He was just completely ravaged. And he would sit down and he would say, I just don't know why I don't feel good. I'm like, you have cancer. And he goes, oh, that could be it. It's like, it's what Jason was like. I mean, when I visit the doctor, I'm reminded that I, too, was sick. See what I'm saying? And still am. Not because of sadness or because in 1976 I wasn't kind to my father at his deli on Kings Highway, Brooklyn. I swept the floor without talking to him, without knowing what work was, and money. When I looked, he was slumped in a chair, pulling the ends of his mustache. I'm not sick because of anything, just because. The doctor digs his fingers into the liquid tumors growing just beneath the skin of my neck and in the crossword puzzle of hair under my armpits. I imagine the yellow leaves hanging from the branches of a willow tree that fell in Paris long ago. A young Chinese nurse stands in the doctor's office, alone in her body, as if under a street lamp, the white neon light of her breath going out of her, going out. I slipped my pants below my knees. When I was in love, I could not get used to the hours with someone in them. What have you been feeling? Doctor asks. Nothing. I turn away and cough. And in that moment, when the doctor is feeling my grainy-skinned, quiet pair of balls in that precise and careful way, I am ashamed that something in me, some absence about myself, some loneliness I've never understood, which sometimes disappoints but which sometimes shows me who I am, is made better by his slight touch. Isn't that interesting? Okay, one last one from Jason. It's called At Sunset. He lived in Provincetown on the Cape and in New York, and the sun, as you know, in the Cape, even though it's in the East Coast, sets into the ocean because the Cape's turned around. facing the wrong way. So you get to actually see what people see in California all the time, you know, the sun setting into the water. At sunset, your death must be loved this much. You have to know the grief now, standing by the water's edge, looking down at the wave touching you. You have to lie stiff, arms folded, on a heap of earth, and see how far the darkness will take you. I mean it. This, now, before the ghost the cold leaves in your breath rises, before the toes are put together inside the shoes. There it is, the goddamn orange going into rose descending circle of beauty and time. You have nothing to be sad about. Isn't that amazing?
Thank you for ending with that.
For Jason.